The colonel himself embraced the looming battle with gusto. "It is not the critic who counts," he had famously preached upon his return from his African safari. "Not the man who points out how the strong man stumbles, or where the doer of deeds could have done better. The credit belongs to the man who is actually in the arena, whose face is marred by dust and sweat and blood, who strives valiantly, who errs and comes short again and again, because there is no effort without error and shortcoming, but who does actually strive to do the deeds, who knows the great enthusiasms, the great devotions, who spends himself in a worthy cause." Indeed, his exuberance for battle manifested itself 3 days before his planned announcement, when he answered a question about his intentions with a spontaneous declaration. "My hat is in the ring." The tradition of shying the hat went back to a time when men either fought in the ring with bare knuckles or flung a hat at a rooster that would only fight when goaded. The former president's reference to fisticuffs and cockfighting, the New York Evening World commented, undoubtedly heralded some brutality in the contest. On Sunday evening, February 25th, Roosevelt's New York office released the governor's request that, in the interests of the people as a whole, the colonel should respond affirmatively to the unsolicited and unsought demand that he enter the race. "I deeply appreciate your letter," Roosevelt publicly replied, affirming, "I will accept the nomination for president if it is tendered to me, and I will adhere to this decision until the convention has expressed its preference." That same night, before news of his decision had become public, Roosevelt attended the Porcellian Club dinner and a meeting of the Harvard overseers, after which he went to the home of his old college friend, Judge Robert Grant. At Roosevelt's request, Grant had invited another college friend, the historian William Roscoe Thayer, and William Allen White, to dinner. While Roosevelt showed no signs of agitation about the upcoming struggle, his friends expressed misgivings about his decision to run and the backlash from the Columbus speech. White continued to believe that public sentiment stood overwhelmingly with Roosevelt, but doubted whether the political system was flexible enough to register that sentiment. If presidential primaries existed across the nation, he was confident Roosevelt would win, but the convention system had myriad ways of thwarting public desire. Grant believed Roosevelt was making an unnecessary and possibly fatal blunder by challenging a sitting president instead of waiting for an open field 4 years later. And Thayer begged him, for the sake of his own future, not to engage in a factional strife which might end his usefulness to the country. The colonel blithely deflected their arguments with animation and good humor. Never losing his composure when Thayer, as a historian, defended the judiciary and argued that Roosevelt's platform would destroy representative government in favor of the whims of the populace, Roosevelt countered that he could identify nearly 4 dozen senators who obtained their offices through the influence of Wall Street. "Do you call that popular representative government?" he queried in response. And when Grant wondered if he would have the backing of party leaders, Roosevelt acknowledged that he had none of them, not even Lodge. Instead, he counted on a cadre of young leaders like Governor Robert Bass of New Hampshire. As the lively conversation broke up around midnight, Grant made one final attempt to dissuade Roosevelt from running, emphasizing that people would think him disloyal to the president. About to retire to the guest room upstairs, Roosevelt angrily declared, "What do I owe to Taft? It was through me and my friends that he became president. I had him in the hollow of my hand, and he would have dropped out." To illustrate his point, he withdrew his pocket knife from his pocket, balanced it in the palm of his hand, then let it clatter to the floor. The president, the first lady, and a few guests, including Archie Butt, were at dinner in the White House when a messenger brought Roosevelt's letter declaring his candidacy. Reading it aloud to those at the table, Taft remarked that it was more definite than he had expected. Assuming it would be laden with conditions and explanations, he was surprised to find it a clear rallying cry to the progressives. Nellie turned to her husband. "I told you so 4 years ago, and you would not believe me," she chided. Her husband gave a good-natured laugh. I know you did, my dear, and I think you are perfectly happy now. You would have preferred the Colonel to have come out against me than to have been wrong yourself." Archie was less able to make light of the revelation, tossing in his bed that night, unable to sleep. A week earlier, with the President's blessing, he had made plans for a short European vacation with his good friend, the painter and sculptor, Frank Millet. Archie had driven himself like a steam engine through the continuous round of dinners and receptions marking the winter social season, and now felt tired all the time. They were planning to sail on the Berlin. "If the old ship goes down," he wrote his sister-in-law Clara, "you'll find my affairs in ship-shape condition." As he lay in his bed that night, Archie had second thoughts about the trip. "It seems to me that the President will need every on team near at hand now. If we are ever to be of any real comfort to him, this is the time," he reflected. "I can see he hates to see me go, and I feel like a quitter in going." That morning he canceled his sailing orders and told the President of his intention to remain in Washington. "He would not hear of it," Archie told his Aunt Kitty, "and insisted on my going, on the ground this was the only time I could get away." On Saturday, March 2nd, Archie Butt sailed for Europe. "He hated to leave the big white chief," he told Clara, "but he'd be back in 6 weeks, returning to the White House in plenty of time to support the President during the fight of his life for the nomination." By a strange coincidence, the Washington Post reported, both Taft and Roosevelt opened their national headquarters on the same day. The Taft men commandeered 12 luxurious rooms in the Raleigh Hotel, while two blocks away, the Roosevelt headquarters occupied the 10th floor of the Muncie Building. To head his campaign, the Colonel chose Montana Senator Joseph M. Dixon, an energetic young man with a very pleasant and winning personality, easy manners, and attractive address. Taft selected Illinois Congressman William Brown McKinley, chairman of the Republican National Committee. No relation to the assassinated president, McKinley had made a fortune in traction corporations before entering Congress in 1905. For both campaigns, major financial backers helped furnish the sinews of war. Roosevelt would enjoy the support of two multimillionaires, Frank Muncy, the publisher of newspapers and magazines, and George Perkins, who had departed the House of Morgan to devote himself to public affairs. Taft could rely on traditional Republican Party stalwarts, including the financiers Otto Bannard and Chauncey Depew. And once again, Charlie Taft contributed handsomely to his brother's campaign. As the battle for the nomination began, Taft was immensely relieved that the Colonel's radical Columbus speech provided the opportunity to distinguish his own position without indulging in any personal attack. Though he agreed with many of the Colonel's proposals on capital and labor, he had felt that the initiative and the referendum were problematic and was unalterably opposed to the recall of judicial decisions. In a letter to Charlie, he noted that Roosevelt had stirred up a veritable hornet's nest of disapproval. The issues were now sharply defined, clearing the political atmosphere wonderfully. Meeting with Roosevelt's friend Henry White in early March, Taft vowed that his campaign would remain a battle of ideas. Indeed, he hoped that when all this turmoil of politics had passed, he and Roosevelt would get together again and be as of old. Speaking in New York, Boston, and Toledo in the late winter and early spring, Taft deployed a series of metaphors to illuminate the inherent dangers in subjecting judicial decisions to the momentary passions of a people. In one late winter speech, he warned that judicial recall would topple the pillars of the temple. In subsequent addresses that spring, the President warned that such action threatened to smash the Ark of the Covenant, and that it laid the axe at the foot of the tree of well-ordered freedom. Defending his beloved judiciary, Taft found his voice. At the State House in Boston, he enjoyed the most genuine ovation of his speaking career. "One cannot adequately describe," he told Charlie, "the manner in which my speech was received, without using extravagant expressions." "Taft has behaved with dignity and amiable forbearance since the announcement," Roosevelt's friend, Judge Grant, told the historian James Ford Rhodes at the end of March, noting that he had become almost an idol, even in circles where a few months ago he was reviled. If Taft triumphed, Grant continued, it would be on the crest of the wave of revolt from and denunciation of Roosevelt. In recent weeks, suspicion that Roosevelt had not granted the president quite the square deal seems to have taken hold of the public mind, and the abuse of the colonel in the New York and Massachusetts newspapers had been overwhelming and bitter. When the election year opened, only one eastern state, New Jersey, and five western states, Wisconsin, Nebraska, Oregon, North Dakota, and California, made use of the direct primary. Everywhere else, delegates would be selected in district and state conventions, where local machines and the power of federal patronage gave the president a decided advantage. Taft's campaign had already established control of most southern state conventions before Roosevelt formally entered the race. Fearful that the region's running totals would make Taft's lead appear impregnable before delegates from the rest of the country were selected, an enterprising Roosevelt supporter organized groups of men to contest the results of conventions throughout the South. Even if it was later determined that legitimate Taft majorities existed, the newspapers would be forced to list the results as contested rather than straight Taft victories. When rumors reached Roosevelt that bribes were being employed, he wrote his overenthusiastic organizer that while he was absolutely sure that there was not a particle of truth to the accusations, he nonetheless wanted assurance that no improper tactics were being used to influence any man. At state conventions in the North and West, brutal altercations broke out, swiftly dispelling Taft's hope for a high-minded campaign based on the issues. In Michigan, Taft's forces secured a victory after what one newspaper described as the worst riots that ever occurred in a political gathering in the state. More than 1,800 men arrived at the Bay City Armory to claim 1,400 seats. The Taft men, the New York Times reported, were admitted first and filled the hall, despite the frantic efforts of the Roosevelt men to gain entrance through side doors, windows, and the basement. With the aid of the state militia, delegates without proper credentials were seized bodily and thrown to the back of the crowd. Eventually, 400 Roosevelt supporters were admitted, and then the fireworks began. When the chairman of the Taft delegation attempted to open the meeting, the colonel's men set up a roar, making it impossible for him to continue. One Roosevelt advocate rushed the platform only to be flung backward, landing atop the newspaper men's table. More than 100 men joined the fight before police charged on the combatants and restored order with their clubs. The Roosevelt faction promptly selected their own delegates before leaving the hall, yelling and jeering at their foes. The Taft faction then moved forward with the regular order of business. Violence erupted at conventions in many other states as well, including Missouri and Oklahoma. In the 3rd Missouri District, the Taft contingent, positioned at the only open door with clubs and baseball bats, prevented Roosevelt supporters from entering. Pandemonium broke out in Oklahoma City when a Roosevelt man wearing a Rough Rider outfit entered the hall on a horse and rode down the aisle to the rostrum. Before an hour had passed, a series of dynamite explosions shook the convention hall. A few weeks later, at a district convention in Guthrie, Oklahoma, a Roosevelt supporter held a loaded gun to the head of the chairman of Taft's delegation. He wanted to be fully prepared, he declared, in case any chicanery occurred. Before the all-night session came to a close, one delegate had dropped dead from an apparent apoplexy. Even before officially throwing his hat in the ring, Roosevelt realized that his only chance for the nomination lay in expanding the direct primary beyond the half-dozen states that had adopted the system. In his letter to the governors, he had voiced his hope that, so far as possible, the people may be given the chance, through direct primaries, to express their preference as to who shall be the nominee. Initially led by La Follette and his band of insurgents, the movement for direct primaries had been slow to catch on. 2 years earlier, Roosevelt had unsuccessfully tried to persuade the New York state legislature to change its nominating system. As a presidential candidate, however, he transformed the sluggishly moving cause into a torrential crusade. "Get the direct primary for your state," proclaimed a Roosevelt supporter in Collier's Weekly, alerting constituents that the presidential primary means that you can go to the polls if you are a Republican and say whether you want Taft or Roosevelt. If you don't do the choosing, the bosses will. Roosevelt operatives pressured legislatures in one state after another to change their rules. "Don't let the politicians tell you it is too late," the progressive journalist Mark Sullivan proclaimed. "The presidential primary can be got for every state if the people demand it." The call for a popular voice in party nominations was a delicate issue for the Taft campaign. While the president's strength lay in the old convention system, the political climate made public opposition to direct primaries awkward. Nor did Taft oppose the concept in principle. He told Horace that he had no objection at all to Republican primaries, so long as the law provided safeguards to prevent Democrats from voting. Meanwhile, his managers did everything possible to prevent states from adopting primaries. "Legislatures are being dragooned. Office holders are being set at work," the Washington Times reported, "and big business is using its influence at every point." Challenged to explain why Taft's campaign organizers were leading the fight, William McKinley flatly stated, "I do not favor changes in the rules of the game while the game is in progress. To propose the recall of conventions in the midst of the campaign is contrary to the dictates of fair play." It appeared the campaign would progress smoothly, Taft assured Horace, "if he could only keep my people from talking too much." Roosevelt sounded the central theme of his own campaign in a speech at Carnegie Hall on March 20th. Every seat was occupied. The speaker's platform was jammed with chairs. Women in evening gowns crowded the upper boxes. 5,000 people had to be turned away. Roosevelt waved his hand energetically to stop the wild cheers that greeted him as he entered, but the demonstration only escalated when someone in the back began the sing-song refrain, "What's the matter with Roosevelt?" to which the crowd chanted, "He's all right." At last, the audience reluctantly quieted, and Roosevelt began to speak. "The great fundamental issue now before the Republican Party and before our people can be stated briefly," he thundered, posing the rhetorical question, "Are the American people fit to govern themselves, to rule themselves, to control themselves? I believe they are. My opponents do not." Declaring that he stood by the sentiments of his Columbus speech, Roosevelt adroitly folded his proposal for the recall of judicial decisions into the larger issue of popular rule. Any attack on his proposal, he maintained, was, in effect, a criticism of all popular government, grounded in the belief that the people are fundamentally unworthy. For the first time, the New York Times reported, Roosevelt proceeded to pour ridicule on the president, deriding his misguided interpretation of the principles of American government. Unlike Abraham Lincoln, who believed in government of the people, by the people, for the people, Roosevelt charged that Taft ostensibly held that our government is and should be a government of all the people by a representative part of the people, the very definition of oligarchy. Where progressives trusted that the entire voting republic would rule correctly most of the time, Taft rested his hope in the courts, a special class of persons wiser than the people. In recent years, Roosevelt pointed out, these very courts had proved the most serious obstacles to social justice, repeatedly striking down legislation designed to better the working conditions of the ordinary citizen. "Our task as Americans is to strive for social and industrial justice, achieved through the genuine rule of the people," he urged. "We, here in America, hold in our hands the hope of the world." The destiny of our great experiment would mean nothing, he warned, if, on this new continent, we merely build another country of great but unjustly divided material prosperity, rather than a genuine democracy based on the rule of all the people. As spring commenced, vigorous efforts by the Roosevelt campaign to spread the direct primary system had succeeded in Pennsylvania, Massachusetts, Maryland, Ohio, South Dakota, Illinois, and New York, bringing the number of participating states to 13. The New York struggle resulted in multiple litigations regarding the format of the ballot and the placement of the delegates' names, but the primary was finally set for March 26th. In Illinois, the Chicago Tribune led a successful campaign to force the reluctant governor to call a special legislative session to pass the bill. With primaries scheduled nearly every week between mid-March and early June, the first presidential campaign conducted under this new system generated widespread interest and high emotions. The primary season opened on March 12th in North Dakota, where Robert La Follette still had his fighting clothes on, determined to prove that he was the sole progressive in the race. Roosevelt, he charged, was merely a switch engine that ran on one track and then on another. Aware that La Follette was generating widespread enthusiasm, Roosevelt's managers published a last-minute appeal in newspapers across the state. Today's primary crucial. On the returns, the statement advised, will depend whether Colonel Theodore Roosevelt is to be further considered as a factor in the fight for the nomination. In Washington, Alice Roosevelt Longworth waited anxiously. After placing repeated telephone calls to her father's campaign manager, she finally received the very bad news that La Follette had beaten Roosevelt by a margin of 58% to 39%. Though Taft garnered but a miserable 3% of the vote, Roosevelt had predicted that if he did not win, the East will construe it not as a defeat for Taft, but as a defeat for me. The Washington Post confirmed Roosevelt's assessment. The small vote count for President Taft means very little, as he was not fighting for recognition of the primaries, as were Roosevelt and La Follette. Moreover, Taft could not anticipate much support in a state on the Canadian border, where many farmers still resented his advocacy for reciprocity. In a nutshell, the Post concluded, the outcome in North Dakota is decidedly embarrassing to Roosevelt, encouraging to La Follette, and the subject of mixed amusement and satisfaction to Taft. A week later, Roosevelt suffered a far more significant loss when Taft crushed him by a margin of 8-1 in New York's first trial of the new primary law, securing 83 out of 90 district delegates. They are stealing the primary election from us, Roosevelt protested. It was evident that an entire breakdown of the election machinery in New York had occurred. Litigation by both the Taft and Roosevelt campaigns had delayed getting the ballots to the printer. In some districts, they arrived only after the polling had closed. In others, the long ballots had been so badly folded that the bottom section bearing the delegates' names became detached. Despite these technical difficulties, the press reported the indisputable fact that Taft had scored a decisive victory over Roosevelt. The day after the New York primary, Roosevelt boarded a train to begin a week-long swing through the West in anticipation of the Illinois primary. Having studied the returns from New York, he reached Chicago in a fighting mood. Discarding his prepared speeches, he raised the cry of fraud, claiming that the Taft men in New York had cheated the people out of their will by the grossest corruption since the days of Tweed. Had he simply been unable to gain support for his political philosophy, the colonel maintained, he should be sorry, but would not complain. If the politicians subvert the will of the people, however, he would have a great deal to say. Buoyed by immense crowds yelling, "Teddy, Teddy, hooray for Teddy," Roosevelt escalated his rhetoric against bosses, machines, and William Howard Taft. "Our fight," he claimed, "is the biggest fight the Republican Party has been in since the Civil War." Before a packed Decatur crowd, he linked Taft directly to Republican William Lorimer, who would soon be expelled from the Senate for bribing members of the Illinois state legislature to obtain his Senate seat. Generating wild applause, he proclaimed, "As an American citizen, it is a shock to me to see the name of Lincoln desecrated by its use as a mask for Mr. Lorimer." Easter came on April 7th that year, Alice Roosevelt recalled, but all that I could think of was the Illinois primary 2 days off. A loss in Illinois after his humiliating New York defeat would cripple the Roosevelt movement. But before midnight on April 9th, it became clear that Roosevelt had won a sweeping victory, carrying every district in the state but one, and electing 56 of the 58 delegates. His campaign secretary, Oscar King Davis, later designated April 9th as the day on which the Roosevelt bandwagon got its real start. And from then on, there was a rush to get aboard it. Well aware that he had benefited from widespread anti-Lorimer sentiment, Roosevelt claimed the stunning victory as a stinging rebuke to the alliance between crooked business and crooked politics. As he headed toward Pennsylvania, where voters would go to the polls in 4 days, he wore his broadest smile. "We slugged them over the ropes," he told supporters. "The outcome was almost too good to believe," Alice Roosevelt recorded in her diary. "How wonderfully happy I am." A somber mood enveloped the Taft camp. Taft confided to Howard Hollister that the Illinois defeat had given his campaign a heavy jolt. More frustrating than the loss itself, Taft told his friend, was the unjust way that the Lorimer issue had been used to debase him. Roosevelt knew that Taft had never supported Lorimer. Indeed, he and the colonel had exchanged letters, working together to determine how they might persuade a reluctant Senate to expel one of its own. Despite the blow suffered in Illinois, Taft assured Hollister, the campaign could easily recover by a good result in Pennsylvania. On Saturday, April 13th, the people of Pennsylvania crushed Taft's hope for turning the avalanche of sentiment that Roosevelt had unleashed. It was long after midnight, the Washington Times reported, before the weary managers quit bringing their discouraging telegrams and Mr. Taft sought a few hours' rest. By Sunday morning, it was clear that Roosevelt had achieved another staggering triumph, gaining 68 of 76 delegates. After hearing the final tally, Taft wrote a long letter to his brother Horace. "One of the burdens that a man leading a cause has to carry is the disappointment that his friends and sympathizers feel at every recurring disaster," he began. "With every unfavorable report in the papers, the load grew heavier. I felt more sorrow at Nellie's disappointment and yours, and that of all who have become absorbed in the fight on my behalf, than I did myself," he explained. Nevertheless, he assured his brother, he had no plans to withdraw, nor did he intend to make any personal attacks on Roosevelt. If Roosevelt persisted in his lies and unblushing misrepresentations, however, he could not prevent his campaign managers from pointing out his mendacity. "I wish I could help," Horace replied. "I can't manage to think of much else. I don't see how you stand it. I don't mind a licking. I can get used to anything. But the continued uncertainty is hard to bear." No matter the eventual outcome, Horace told his brother, William Taft would never lose the affection and respect of the thinking men, the men who understood the fight being waged for the Constitution. Hoping to cheer his brother, Horace recounted a conversation with Taft's eldest son, Robert, who had never loved him so much, and expressed certainty that his place in history is sure if he never does another lick. "The stampede is on," the Pittsburgh press proclaimed. "Those who have been led to believe that Roosevelt has been fighting a lost cause will have to change their minds. Theodore Roosevelt is stronger today than he has been at any time since his hat was cast into the ring." Optimism reigned, too, at Roosevelt's headquarters in Washington. "Of course, Pennsylvania settles it," Chicago Tribune correspondent Cal O'Loughlin wrote to Roosevelt on April 14th. "I'm absolutely convinced that you will be nominated hands down at Chicago." Noting with satisfaction that the gloom around the White House today is so thick, it could be cut with a knife. Keeping abreast of the increasingly bitter nomination struggle from abroad, Major Butt decided to cut his vacation a little short, anxious to be home, where he could offer comfort and companionship to his beleaguered chief. On April 10th, 1912, he boarded the White Star Line's palatial new ocean liner, RMS Titanic, for her maiden crossing of the North Atlantic. On Monday morning, April 15th, the press reported that the Titanic, carrying more than 2,300 passengers and crew, had struck a giant iceberg. The first reports erroneously suggested that the great ship had been held afloat by her watertight compartments and was slowly crawling toward Halifax. Relieved to hear that all aboard had been saved, Taft went to see the comedy Nobody's Widow at Poley's Theater that evening. Learning at around 11 p.m. that the ship had actually gone down in the early morning hours, he looked, one reporter observed, like a man who had been stunned by a heavy blow. He rushed back to his office, where he closeted himself in the telegraph room to read the latest bulletins. Shortly before midnight, he dispatched a telegram to the White Star offices in New York. "Have you any information concerning Major Butt? If you communicate at once, I will greatly appreciate." The response offered little reason for optimism. There was no definite information available. Before returning to the mansion, Taft instructed the telegraph operator to bring him the most recent news, regardless of how late it arrived. The days that followed would drive Taft down into a profound state of grief. By early Tuesday morning, White Star officials had compiled a list of over 700 survivors, mainly women and children, who had been loaded into lifeboats and taken aboard the nearby Carpathia. At noon, the Washington Times reported, "The president's telegraph operator received a message from the White Star office expressing their profound regret that Major Butt's name was not to be found on any list of survivors." Even with a list of the rescued made public, the press reported, Washington found it hard to realize that the president's military aide, the tall, stalwart, light-hearted man who won such popularity, who knew pretty nearly everybody in the Capitol and was loved by all of them, is really dead. The White House canceled all social activities as news of the disaster swallowed up all such temporary minor considerations as politics and official business. Both the president and the first lady were greatly depressed, the Washington Post reported. In fact, the entire White House staff was plunged into sorrow. With tears in his eyes, Taft told callers he considered Archie a member of his family and felt his loss as if he had been a younger brother. To his friend Mabel Boardman, Taft confessed that it was impossible to believe he would never see Archie again. "I miss him every minute," he wrote. "Every house and every tree and every person suggests him. Every walk I take somehow is lacking his presence, and every door that opens seems to be his coming." As survivors began talking about their ordeal, Taft absorbed stories about Archie's last hours. Marion Thayer, a Philadelphia mainliner whose husband had perished on the ship, sent a heartfelt letter to the president. "In my own grief, I think often of yours," she told him, "and feel I must write to tell you how I spent the last Sunday evening with Major Butt." She had dined with Archie at a small dinner party in honor of the Titanic's captain, Edward J. Smith, and could not forget how devoted he was to you and what a lovely, noble man he was. Archie had told Mrs. Thayer about the scores of letters he had written to his mother and his sister-in-law over the recent years, and shared his hope that if published posthumously, this correspondence might leave his mark and memorial of truth to the world. He admitted that he was very nervous about returning home, Marion confided to Taft, "knowing that the nomination battle between you and someone else he loved, but I do not, was in full swing." "Oh, how he loved you," she added, "and how frightfully you will miss his care. Such a true, devoted, close, more than friend." According to reports, Archie had been in the smoking room enjoying a game of cards at 11:40 p.m. when the Titanic hit the iceberg. A slight rocking of the ship followed, but the passengers remained unaware of danger until 40 minutes later, when a steward announced, "The captain says that all passengers will dress themselves warmly, bring life preservers, and go up to the top deck." Over the next 2 hours, as water continued to flood the vessel, women and children were lowered into lifeboats. Mrs. Henry Harris, wife of the celebrated theatrical producer who died on board, recalled that Archie Butt had been the real leader during the rescue operation. A male passenger who survived by jumping at the last moment told reporters, "My last view of Major Butt, one that will live forever in my memory, was with that brave soldier coolly aiding the officers of the boat in directing the disembarkation of the women from the doomed ship." Even before the limited survivor list and the testimony of witnesses reached him, William Taft was grimly certain of his companion's fate. After I heard that part of the ship's company had gone down, I gave up hope for the rescue of Major Butt, unless by accident. I knew that he would certainly remain on the ship's deck until every duty had been performed and every sacrifice made. Theodore Roosevelt was on a whirlwind speaking tour through the West when the tragic news of the disaster reached him. From Lynchburg, Kansas, he paid tribute to his former aide. Major Butt was the highest type of officer and gentleman. He met his end as an officer and gentleman should, giving up his own life that others might be saved. I and my family all loved him sincerely. For Alice Roosevelt, who was especially close to Archie, the loss was particularly painful. "I can't believe it," she repeatedly recorded in her diary. "I can't believe it." Taft immediately prepared for the journey to Augusta, Georgia, where he would speak at the memorial service in his devoted aide's hometown. Shops were closed, flags flew at half-mast, and thousands gathered around the Grand Opera House hoping to hear the president speak. "Everybody knew Archie as Archie," Taft began. "I cannot go into a box at a theater. I cannot turn around in my room. I cannot go anywhere without expecting to see his smiling face or to hear his cheerful voice in greeting. The life of the president is rather isolated, and those appointed to live with him come much closer to him than anyone else." Before reaching the end of his prepared remarks, he broke down and could not finish. Heavy-hearted, Taft endeavored to return to a rush of activities in preparation for the April 30th Massachusetts primary, which the press had deemed the Gettysburg of the Republican presidential test. If the president could not win the Bay State, the very heart of the section where he is supposed to be the strongest, commentators noted, the curtain will ring down on his candidacy. Fully aware of the stakes, Taft decided to buck the tradition that kept sitting presidents from campaigning on their own behalf, announcing that he would deliver his message in person to the people of Massachusetts. For weeks, Taft's campaign advisers had argued that it was absolutely essential for him to open fire on the former president. Taft had refused, believing it undignified to get down into the ring of crimination and recrimination. The walloping he suffered in Illinois and Pennsylvania, however, persuaded him that the time had come to answer Roosevelt's charges. His campaign announced that Taft would explode a bomb that would level Roosevelt's false accusation. When he finished drafting his speeches, Taft circulated them to his cabinet at an all-night session. Apparently, one Washington correspondent reported, the president's idea of severity was not as strong as that of some of his advisers. Informed of the proposed attack, Roosevelt laughed. "Frightful," he mockingly replied. The president's train reached Springfield, Massachusetts, in the early afternoon of April 25th. Speaking in a half-dozen small towns en route to Boston, where he would deliver his principal address that evening, Taft revealed acute discomfort at the need to defend himself against the accusations of an old friend, whom he greatly admired and loved. A man who had helped make him president. "This wrenches my soul," he admitted. If the fight were purely personal, he would have remained silent. But it was his duty to represent the cause of constitutionalism, and he could not allow Roosevelt's false charges to go unanswered. When he arrived at South Station, he learned that an immense crowd had already filled the new Boston Arena, with thousands more packed into Symphony Hall. Anticipation that he would deliver a fighting speech had revitalized his supporters. "Mr. Roosevelt," Taft began, "claims to believe that every man is entitled to a square deal. I propose to examine the charges he makes against me, and to ask you whether in making them he is giving me a square deal." With emotion in his voice, throwing aside official reserve, Taft proceeded to tell the cold, naked truth about Theodore Roosevelt, presenting hard evidence to counter each of his rival's major accusations. He began by producing a transcript to prove that he had never stated, as Roosevelt repeatedly claimed, that our government is and should be a government of all the people by a representative part of the people. In fact, he had pointed out that major segments of the population remained voiceless, while the people included only adult males, since women were not allowed to vote. Nor had he ever been a supporter of the disgraced Senator Lorimer, as Roosevelt well knew. To prove his point, Taft read out the letter to the colonel in which he had suggested a joint strategy for removing Lorimer from the Senate. Yet another letter revealed Roosevelt's dishonorable opportunism. While the reciprocity agreement was being hammered out with Canada, Roosevelt had written to tell Taft that it was admirable from every standpoint. Yet facing the opposition of angry farmers, the colonel had hastily revised his position. Taft pushed relentlessly onward, refuting each of 11 accusations Roosevelt had made against him in the course of the campaign. Nearly 2 hours had passed before Taft reached his peroration, which included a solemn warning to the American people regarding the danger of a third presidential term. Mr. Roosevelt, he stated, is convinced that the American people think that he is the only one to do the job. Though Roosevelt had never articulated exactly what that job entailed, the ambitious plans outlined in his Columbus platform could not possibly be completed in 4 years. We are left to infer, therefore, that the job which Mr. Roosevelt is to perform is one that may take a long time, perhaps the rest of his natural life. There is not the slightest reason why, if he secures a third term, and the limitation of the Washington, Jefferson, and Jackson tradition is broken down, he should not have as many terms as his natural life will permit. Taft concluded with an ominous question, implying the full danger of granting Roosevelt an unprecedented third term. If he is necessary now to the government, why not later? The audience, which had loudly cheered Taft throughout the entire speech as each item was submitted to the square deal balance and found wanting, received his final words with a storm of endorsement. As his advisers had urged, William Taft had finally struck back. He had cause for exhilaration, his biographer remarked, but weariness and depression were the only sensations he felt. Informed that evening that several hundred bodies, recovered from the icy waters near the site where the Titanic went down, were being taken to Halifax, Taft had dispatched an army official to the city wharf to scrutinize every victim in the hope of recovering the body of Archie Butt. After his speech at the arena, Taft stopped at Symphony Hall to meet the overflow crowd. It was after midnight by the time he returned to his private car. Spent, he slumped over, and despite the presence of a journalist, began to weep. In sharp contrast, Theodore Roosevelt was in great spirits as he prepared his own Boston speech, scheduled for delivery at Mechanics Hall the very next night. "If they are anxious for a fight, they can have it," he blasted as he flung aside his earlier draft to respond to Taft's allegations. Incited by his belligerent tone, the crowd was keyed up from the start. They stamped in unison, shouting, "Hit him between the eyes, soak him, put him over the ropes." The colonel did not disappoint, delivering what the New York Times called a merciless denunciation of his former friend, flaying the president in one scathing sentence after another. With each thrust Roosevelt delivered, the audience howled with delight, spurring him onward. Roosevelt dismissed Taft's square deal comment out of hand. "Taft has not only been disloyal to our past friendship, he has been disloyal to every canon of decency and fair play," he countered. "He only discovered I was dangerous to the people when I discovered he was useless to the people." Insisting that a gentleman's unpardonable sin is to publish a letter marked confidential, the colonel claimed that the president was guilty of the crookedest kind of deal. Categorically, he stated, "I care nothing for Taft's personal attitude toward me." "This is our first presidential campaign under the preference primary plan," the New York Times editorialized 2 days later. "We hope it may be our last. The spectacle presented by the fierce fight for the nomination is one that must be amazing to foreigners. It is one that should bring a blush of shame to the cheek of every American." The old system, the Times continued, under which candidates were content to await the action of the convention and appeal to the people in a formal acceptance speech, was a rational, a seemly procedure. "Under this new system, we are no longer a people, but a mob." On April 30th, the Massachusetts voters granted Taft a narrow victory. But 6 days later, Roosevelt captured Maryland, and the following week, California. Then came the battle for Ohio, which brought both men to the Buckeye State for 10 days of hard campaigning. Traveling thousands of miles by train from one corner of the state to the other, Taft and Roosevelt sometimes found themselves playing rival matinees in the same towns. With each passing day, the tone of the campaign degenerated further. Roosevelt called the president a puzzlewit and a fathead, while Taft railed against his rival's egotism. "You'd suppose there was not anybody in the country to do this job he talks about but himself," the president ridiculed. "It's I all the time with him." Robert La Follette, having traveled to Ohio after a surprisingly good showing in California, joined in the bitter attacks, focusing most of his ire on Roosevelt. While some people found the spectacle of a president and ex-president hurling personal abuse at each other unseemly, the attacks of one on the other won the loudest applause everywhere. "It is about as painful for me as it possibly could be," Taft confessed as the contest in Ohio drew near. "At least, if it is settled against me, it will be finally settled," he told his Aunt Delia. "I have had a long and, I hope, an honorable career, and one in which good fortune has been with me at many crises. If, now, fortune is to desert me for a time or permanently, it is my business to stand it, and I hope I have the courage to do so." Roosevelt, by contrast, found pleasure in every aspect of the campaign. He reveled in the sight of the enormous crowds that greeted him at every stop. He enjoyed going after his rival, bantering with the press, talking with local officials. "He is having a perfectly corking time," one reporter noted, "and has said so a dozen times." On May 21st, a jubilant Roosevelt carried the state of Ohio by a margin of 55% to 39% of the popular vote. Beating Taft in his own state had settled the contest, he predicted. "It will be hopeless to try to beat us at the convention." A week later, Roosevelt carried both New Jersey and South Dakota, bringing the primary season to an end. In 9 of the 13 states where direct primaries had been held, Roosevelt had won overwhelming victories. Taft had carried only New York and Massachusetts. La Follette had secured North Dakota and Wisconsin. The total popular vote for Roosevelt stood at 1,214,969, while Taft secured 865,835 votes and La Follette 327,357 votes. "I have had so many jolts," the despondent Taft told Horace, bespeaking a battering far beyond the political arena, to intimate his sorrow over the ugly estrangement from Theodore Roosevelt and a profound grief for his lost companion Archie Butt, "that I am not worrying over it." Chapter 28. Bosom Friends, Bitter Enemies. To observers across the nation, and even overseas, it was clear an unprecedented challenge to President Taft was well underway. A month ago, practically every impartial observer believed that Mr. Roosevelt had no chance, the Times of London noted as the primary season drew to an end. Now, however, it is admitted on all hands that he has a chance. As Republicans completed preparations to meet in Chicago in mid-June to choose their nominee for president, William Jennings Bryan predicted that the Republican National Convention of 1912 would be the most exciting ever held in the history of the country. Not only were the main contenders once bosom friends who had become bitter enemies, but the country had never before witnessed a fight for the nomination between a president and an ex-president. "Each side makes confident assertions," one correspondent for the New York Tribune remarked, "but each side secretly is scared stiff." Roosevelt steadfastly maintained that the people had already spoken. The vast majority of primary voters had chosen him, furnishing a significant percentage of the 540 delegates he needed to secure the nomination. The convention, he confidently asserted, would not dare to oppose the will of the majority, because to do so would mean ruin to the Republican Party. The president, however, had far greater support in states where party organizations had retained control of the selection process. Taft believed he had accumulated enough delegates in non-primary states to win at Chicago. In truth, neither campaign arrived in the Windy City with enough votes to take the nomination on the first ballot. "No man in this city, nor any man in this hemisphere," the Tribune reporter figured, "knows absolutely who will be nominated for president." Before the convention could begin its proceedings, the Republican National Committee had to settle disputes over 254 seats. These contested seats represented more than half the votes necessary for victory, and the turbulent nomination fight had generated scores of rival delegations. Meeting in Chicago 12 days before the convention, the committee was charged with determining the legitimacy of the competing claims. Lawyers from both sides were prepared with detailed affidavits, but there, the New York Sun noted, resemblance to a civilized courtroom setting would likely end. "Emotions were running high," the paper declared, "and the lawyers and witnesses and contestants are liable to break out into fisticuffs and thump each other around the committee room." There were some contests, of course. Roosevelt ought to win, Taft acknowledged. But he believed the vast majority of the disputes brought by the colonel's campaign had been intended merely to generate publicity. Most important, the National Committee comprised loyal Taft supporters, whom Roosevelt would not be able to frighten or bulldoze. To Roosevelt's detriment, the first contests to be decided were from the South, where Taft had legitimately secured most of the delegates before his opponent even entered the race. The Roosevelt campaign had never expected to win these contests. Indeed, they had been instituted simply to keep Taft's delegate count from appearing insurmountable before the northern primaries commenced. When these early cases came before the committee, even Roosevelt's men voted to seat the Taft delegates, conceding that in most instances the contestants had failed to make out a case. In Oyster Bay, Roosevelt followed the hearings with dismay, anxious that decisions in Taft's favor would begin to sound all too familiar. In one Alabama district where Roosevelt had a reasonable case for seating two of his delegates, the committee nonetheless assigned the two places to Taft, confirming his fears. Roosevelt issued a fierce denouncement of the decision, charging that men had been sent to the penitentiary for less reprehensible election frauds than the theft of that delegation. The colonel's bombastic statement succeeded in riveting public attention on the actions of the National Committee. While the public outcry stiffened the spine of his supporters, it simultaneously hardened the attitudes of the Taft committeemen. On subsequent rulings in critical contests in Washington, Indiana, Texas, and California, the committee divided along straight partisan lines, with 39 members consistently voting for Taft's delegates, 14 for Roosevelt's. Even impartial observers agreed that in the cases of Washington and Indiana, the committee's decisions complied with neither justice nor logic. In Washington, the first primaries ever held in Spokane, Tacoma, and Seattle favored Roosevelt by 2-1 and sometimes 10-1 margins. Overwhelming support in these populous areas should have secured him a majority of the state's 14 delegates. But when evidence of fraud and irregularities in the city's primaries surfaced at the hearings, the National Committee decided it had no choice but to stand by the proceedings of the state party organization, which had selected Taft. In Indiana, the committee reversed itself, declining to examine a series of questionable district primaries in which Taft had emerged the clear victor. Though Roosevelt's team demonstrated that repeat voting had occurred, and that some Indianapolis ballots had not been counted, the committee claimed that it was too late to relitigate the election results. The National Committee's decision to award the majority of the Texas delegates to Taft represented what many considered the most glaring violation of fair play. Texas was the sole southern state where the leader of the state party, Cecil Andrew Lyon, was a Roosevelt man. Lyon had accompanied the colonel on his hunting trip in 1905 and remained a personal friend. At the state convention, Lyon engineered a solid victory for Roosevelt. The committee acknowledged that the Roosevelt delegation had been legally chosen according to party rules, but claimed that the rival Taft delegation, selected at a rump convention, had greater popular support. Seating the Taft delegation, the committee argued, was an important step toward eliminating boss rule in the state of Texas. California was one of the last contests the committee considered. The hearing should have been simple. The California legislature had passed a primary law calling for delegates to be elected at large. Roosevelt, who had won the state by a margin of 77,000 votes, argued he was entitled to all 26 of the state's delegates. Taft had carried one district, the 4th Congressional District of San Francisco. The committee gave two San Francisco seats to Taft. The rhetoric from both campaigns grew more vitriolic with each passing day. Taft's campaign manager, William McKinley, claimed that the Roosevelt forces were taking desperate measures to forestall the inevitability of Taft's nomination on the first ballot. It was common knowledge, McKinley asserted, that several Negro delegates from the South had been brazenly approached by Roosevelt men with offers of money to switch their allegiance to the colonel. "I dare them to name any of our men involved in bribery," Senator Joseph Dixon retorted. "McKinley is like a cuttlefish," he added, "that muddies the water, that his own hideousness may not be seen." Of the 254 contested seats, the National Committee finally awarded 235 to Taft and but 19 to Roosevelt. While most analysts agree that Taft rightfully won the great majority of the Southern contests, which yielded over 150 delegates, the 100 remaining seats are subject to debate. Roosevelt likely deserved to win somewhere between 30 and 50. Even with 50 additional delegates, however, he would have been short of a majority. Still, with the help of La Follette's delegates, Taft's nomination on the first ballot might be prevented, and then anything was possible. As the committee hearings wound to a close, Roosevelt's campaign managers decided that they must do something to crystallize the public spirit, to force public indignation, or arouse enough public sentiment to compel the nomination of Roosevelt. The temporary role of delegates established by the National Committee still had to be sanctioned by the convention's Committee on Credentials and voted upon by the delegates as a whole. Aware that time was running out, Senator Dixon prevailed upon Roosevelt to take the unprecedented step of coming to Chicago in person. Roosevelt needed little encouragement. On June 14th, he and Edith drove together to his Outlook office in New York. Reporters noted that he seemed in a gay mood, sporting a new sombrero with a 5-inch brim. The old hat he had worn when he gave his controversial Columbus speech, he quipped, had been kicked around the ring enough to warrant a new one. The colonel sequestered himself in his office for several hours before appearing in the lobby with a prepared statement. A small knot of professional politicians, he charged, were trying to steal the right of the people to make their own nomination. The rank and file of Republican voters, having clearly expressed their will in the primaries, were not in the mood to see their victory stolen from them. On the day Roosevelt boarded the Lakeshore Limited bound for Chicago, the president issued a brief statement from the White House. "All the information I get is that I will be nominated on the first ballot with votes to spare," Taft announced. He had remained silent during the proceedings of the National Committee, leaving Washington correspondents to chronicle his social life, a trip with Nellie to present diplomas to Annapolis cadets, a sail on the Mayflower to Hampton Roads, a dinner for Guatemala's Minister of Foreign Affairs, an evening party on Capitol Hill, and a golf game at Chevy Chase. While Taft remained tight-lipped, his campaign spokesman made headlines, depicting Roosevelt's journey to Chicago as an undeniable admission of defeat. Recalling the colonel's assertion that he would not go unless it proved absolutely necessary, William McKinley claimed that the trip represented the last hope of a lost cause. New York boss William Barnes issued an acid personal attack. "Mr. Roosevelt's departure for Chicago was inevitable. Undignified as it is, and impotent as it will prove to be, its chief interest lies in the disclosure of the mania for power over which Mr. Roosevelt has no control." The people of Chicago greeted the arrival of Theodore Roosevelt quite differently. Word that Roosevelt was en route drove the city plumb crazy with excitement. ordinary business was suspended as tens of thousands made plans to celebrate Roosevelt's arrival. In the Loop District, one reporter observed, there wasn't an office boy on the job. It seemed that everyone had lost a grandmother and had failed to show up for work. Scuffles erupted in hotel lobbies as Roosevelt delegates routinely cried out thief at men sporting Taft badges. Armed with megaphones, Roosevelt supporters belted out songs for Teddy, only to be met with jeers and hoots by equal numbers of Taft men. A bartender at one of the leading hotels offered a special campaign drink garnished with a lemon peel cut to resemble a Rough Rider hat. The circumference of the cocktail glass symbolized the political ring into which the colonel had metaphorically flung his hat. Patrons who kept the lemon peel in the glass as they consumed the gin and vermouth concoction were Roosevelt men. Those who discarded it supported Taft. Hours before Roosevelt's train arrived at LaSalle Station, three bands and an immense crowd waving Teddy flags and wearing Roosevelt buttons had gathered at the railway yards. The sight of the colonel, teeth agleam, romantic headgear, burly arms waving greetings, was catalytic, reported Mark Sullivan. A mob, shouting, laughing, cheering, shoving, engulfed the police and took Roosevelt to its bosom. Thousands of screaming men and women lined the streets as the former president rode in an open car to the Congress Hotel. So frenzied was the crowd in the lobby that it took a team of five men using football tactics to propel Roosevelt to the elevator. No sooner had the colonel reached the quiet of his room than he clambered from a window onto a balcony over Michigan Avenue, anxious to satisfy the expectations of the waiting crowd. His appearance was the signal for a roar, the New York Times reported. Smiling broadly and waving his hat, he initiated the wild acclaim of the people for several minutes before leaning over the stone railing to speak. "Chicago is a mighty poor place in which to try and steal anything," he roared. "Give it to 'em, Colonel," the crowd thundered in return. "Knock 'em out." In answer to their entreaties, he went directly after the president. "The receiver of stolen goods is no better than a thief," he fiercely pronounced. "The people will win. We have won in every state where the people could express themselves, 3-1 and sometimes 8-1. This is a naked fight against corrupt politicians and thieves, and the thieves will not win." Before Roosevelt went to dinner that night, a newspaper man asked whether he was prepared to stand up to the rigors of what lay ahead. His answer provided the enduring symbol of his campaign. "I'm feeling like a bull moose," he replied, invoking the antlered king of the northern woods, whose supposed instinct to gore his antagonist reflected Roosevelt's combative mood. "He is essentially a fighter," Elihu Root said of his old friend. "And when he gets into a fight, he is completely dominated by the desire to destroy his adversary." The bull moose icon captured the imagination of the American people. Images of the massive creature suddenly appeared on posters and placards all over the country, while button manufacturers desperately tried to keep up with demand. The teddy bear had been supplanted by a far more imposing and belligerent mascot. The following Monday, June 17th, Roosevelt put in one of the busiest days of his life, a very frenzy of activity, which amazed and startled even his close associates. He met with streams of supporters, interviewed Taft delegates who might be persuaded to change their minds, conferred with the seven governors, and talked with reporters, all the while continuing to draft the address he would deliver that evening to a very frenzy of activity, which amazed and startled even his close associates. He met with streams of supporters, interviewed Taft delegates who might be persuaded to change their minds, conferred with the seven governors, and talked with reporters, all the while continuing to draft the address he would deliver that evening to a mass audience. It was evident, a Chicago Daily Tribune reporter marveled, that the colonel had not lost any of his magnetism. And he had retained the gift for making every caller feel that he was, at that moment, the exact person of all the world's population he loved and most desired to see. More than 20,000 people clamored for tickets to hear Roosevelt's final speech of the nominating campaign. His managers had reserved the auditorium, advertised as the largest theater in the United States west of the Alleghenies, though in actuality it seated only 4,200. At 6 p.m., police shut down all the surrounding streets, allowing only ticket holders to enter the cordoned area. Hundreds of eager bystanders without tickets deployed all manner of ingenious schemes to gain entrance. Women claimed their husbands and children were already inside. Men insisted they were members of the Glee Club or the Platform Committee. All were steadfastly denied by the police. Every seat was filled long before Roosevelt arrived. An organist played patriotic tunes while the audience sang along. A great roar greeted the colonel's entrance, and the avalanche of applause continued for nearly 5 minutes. At last, Roosevelt stretched out his arms and began delivering what critics considered not only the most moving speech of his career, but one of the most dramatic speeches ever made. He had decided to run, Roosevelt explained, only when convinced that Mr. Taft had definitely and completely abandoned the cause of the people and had surrendered himself wholly to the biddings of the professional political bosses and of the great privileged interests standing behind them. He entreated those still backing Senator La Follette to join with him, for he had honestly earned the overwhelming majority of the votes of the Republican progressive vote, and he alone could win the fight against Taft. He then set forth two maxims. First, those delegates fraudulently put on the temporary roll by the dishonest action of the majority of the National Committee must be barred from voting. Second, if they were allowed to participate, then progressives would not be bound by the actions of the convention. Buoyed by the thunderous approval of the crowd, Roosevelt rolled toward his final call to arms. "A period of change is upon us," he proclaimed, warning that "our opponents, the men of reaction, ask us to stand still. But we could not stand still if we would. We must either go forward or go backward. It would be far better to fail honorably for the cause we champion than it would be to win by foul methods the foul victory for which our opponents hope. But the victory shall be ours, and it shall be won as we have already won so many victories, by clean and honest fighting for the loftiest of causes. We fight in honorable fashion for the good of mankind. Fearless of the future, unheeding of our individual fates, with unflinching hearts and undimmed eyes, we stand at Armageddon, and we battle for the Lord." The hall erupted in tumultuous, sustained applause. "There is no question," William Allen White observed, "that the psychology of the situation, the enthusiasm of the crowds, the lonesomeness at Taft headquarters, and the energy of the Roosevelt workers all point to Roosevelt's nomination." "Still," White reflected, "it is delegates rather than psychology that make nominations." By the commencement of the Republican National Convention on June 18th, the atmosphere was so tense that extraordinary preparations were made to preserve the peace. More than 1,000 policemen were deployed to the Colosseum, a massive stone structure 2 squares in length and 1 in width, capable of seating more than 12,000 people. "Passions have been unloosed. Anger has been unbridled," the Washington Post reported. It is almost incredible to hear at a national convention the question seriously discussed if there will be firearms used and whether blood will be shed. But one can hear this at every step in the frightful jam and welter in the hotel lobbies. In the comfort of the White House that morning, Taft was detached both physically and emotionally from the turmoil in Chicago. "Whatever happens," he wrote to Horace, "I shall be glad to have the strain over." With each passing month, the gulf between Taft and Roosevelt had grown. Taft had long considered himself a moderate progressive, aligned almost perfectly with the sentiments and policies of his old friend. In the throes of the brutal campaign, however, he had withdrawn increasingly from the more progressive ideas. "If I am nominated, I shall have to take my stand as the representative of the conservative, sober, second thought of the people of the United States," he told one friend. "I may go down to defeat if a bolt is started by Roosevelt, the president acknowledged to another. But I will retain the regular organization of the party as a nucleus about which the conservative people who are in favor of maintaining constitutional government can gather. Before convening his cabinet at 10 that morning, Taft spoke by long-distance telephone to his campaign team. McKinley and Charles Hillis were hopeful that they had the votes from the temporary list of delegates to win the crucial election of the convention's presiding officer, known as the temporary chair. Taft's candidate was New York Senator Elihu Root, perhaps the shrewdest decision of his entire campaign. William Allen White described the 67-year-old Root as the most learned, even erudite, distinguished, and impeccable conservative, a calm, serene, and sure leader, capable of dominating any gathering. Indeed, Roosevelt himself had once described his former Secretary of State as the ablest man that has appeared in the public life of any country in any position in my time. Such praise came before Elihu Root had backed William Taft through the bitter primary season. Now, Roosevelt announced his blistering opposition to Root's candidacy for the chairmanship, declaring, "Mr. Root stands as the representative of reaction. He is put forward by the bosses and the representatives of special privilege. He has ranged himself against the men who stand for progressive principles." Roosevelt's vituperative charges, Root's biographer observes, were cruel thrusts at an old friend, and Root felt them. In an equally canny move, the Roosevelt team chose Wisconsin Governor Francis McGovern as their candidate for the chairmanship. A few weeks earlier, Roosevelt had asked Dixon to think over whether it would not be a good play, wise, to have McGovern of Wisconsin permanent chairman. "Not only was Wisconsin's popular governor a fine fellow, but our choice of him would emphasize, as nothing else would, the fact that we wish all progressives to stand together." 3 days later, Roosevelt approached McGovern directly. "I assume that you will make the nominating speech for La Follette, and this would leave all the La Follette men at entire liberty to stand by him. If McGovern then ran for chair with the backing of the Roosevelt team, the progressives would present a united front." When McGovern agreed, Roosevelt was delighted, hoping that state pride would lead La Follette's 26 delegates to support the selection of McGovern for chair. At noon, Republican National Chair Victor Rosewater called the convention to order. Rosewater had been designated to take charge of the proceedings until the election of the chair. But before Rosewater had the chance to call for nominations for the position, Roosevelt's floor leader, Missouri's Herbert Hadley, rose and motioned that 72 of the most fiercely contested Taft delegates, fraudulently included in the temporary role by the National Committee, should be replaced by honestly elected Roosevelt delegates. The method by which the Roosevelt team arrived at the figure of 72 remains a matter of conjecture. 3 years later, a disaffected former intimate of the colonel informed Taft that Hadley had approached Roosevelt, suggesting a determined fight on 24 or 28 seats that had clearly been stolen from them in states such as Texas, Washington, California, and Indiana. Roosevelt, with characteristic emphasis and energy, immediately tripled that figure, knowing how many votes he needed to control the convention. Hadley's motion to bar participation of the 72 contested delegates brought great cheers from Roosevelt supporters. After silence was restored, Indiana's James Watson, a Taft spokesman, insisted that Hadley's motion was not in order on the ground that the convention itself had no chairman as yet, and therefore could not take up any business. Rosewater allowed 40 minutes of debate on the motion before rendering the critical ruling that Hadley's motion was, indeed, out of order, and straightaway opened nominations for the chairmanship. As expected, Root's nomination was greeted with cheers from Taft's supporters, while McGovern drew equal enthusiasm from the Roosevelt side. A wave of surprise swept the hall, however, when La Follette's manager, Walter Hauser, stood and forcibly insisted that McGovern's candidacy was not with La Follette's consent. La Follette, he continued, would strike no deal whatsoever with Roosevelt. Hauser's words propelled La Follette boosters to their feet, waving a large banner bearing the words, "We'll heed not Taffy's smile, nor Teddy's toothsome grin, for it's La Follette once, La Follette twice, and La Follette till we win." It seemed, the New York Tribune observed, that La Follette preferred to see Senator Root elected rather than to see Colonel Roosevelt win the initial contest of the convention. Roosevelt's failure to reconcile with La Follette would prove costly. So raucous was the atmosphere in the hall that nearly 3 hours passed before the voting was completed. When Rosewater announced that Root had defeated McGovern by a narrow margin of 558 to 501, pandemonium erupted. Pennsylvania's William Flynn marched up onto the platform, jabbed a finger at Root, and screamed out, "Receiver of stolen goods!" This brazen accusation prompted a series of fistfights that would have escalated into wholesale rioting without police intervention. Root approached the speaker's table to deliver his keynote address, apparently unperturbed by sweating, wrathful faces in the pit. Marveling at the senator's comportment, William White reflected that hundreds of Root's outraged fellow Republicans, men who had once been his friends, were glaring at him with eyes distraught with hate. Still, White observed, Root's hands did not tremble, his face did not flicker. That afternoon, in lieu of an anxious White House vigil for convention bulletins, Taft and Nellie had motored to the ballpark to attend a Nationals baseball game. When the president entered the stadium, the exuberant crowd of more than 20,000 loudly cheered him for 5 minutes, the men throwing their hats into the air and the women waving their handkerchiefs. In a brief speech, Taft congratulated the team on their astonishing record, winning 16 games in a row, before settling into his box to enjoy the action. So absorbed did he become in the game, which the Nationals won, that he never called for any updated bulletins. Returning to the White House, he discovered, to his great satisfaction, that Elihu Root had defeated Francis McGovern. Roosevelt, meanwhile, had monitored every twist and turn of the proceedings by wire and telephone. All afternoon, hundreds of supporters had gathered in the Florentine room of the Congress Hotel, where news from the convention floor was relayed by telephone to a man with a megaphone. It was his duty, one journalist for the New York Times recorded, to shout out the various incidents of the colonel's triumphant progress to those packing the room and the noisy throng assembled in the hallways and the lobby below. There were frequent cheers from the crowd, the Times reporter wrote, but as it progressed and the tide began to fall, threatening to leave the colonel stranded on the political sands, the megaphone man lost his enthusiasm and his voice. When word spread that Roosevelt had lost his preliminary skirmish, the crowd fell silent. The colonel remained in seclusion for a short time while he and Dixon debated their next move. Later that night, he called a meeting of his delegates. Infusing them with his own energy and defiance, he urged them to stand by him as he resumed the fight to purge the tainted delegate role once the convention came to order the following morning. As delegates and spectators gathered for the second day of the convention, June 19th, electricity filled the air. The Coliseum was a powder mine. With the chairman in place and the convention open for business, Hadley once again moved to replace the 72 contested Taft delegates with Roosevelt men. Chairman Root allowed 3 hours of debate on the motion. Watson, speaking for the Taft campaign, persuasively countered Hadley's motion, insisting that the full convention had no knowledge and was in no temper to pass upon these contests. Evaluating the merits of the National Committee's controversial decisions belonged, finally, to the Committee on Credentials, which would be officially appointed later that day. After conferring with Hadley, Watson announced that a compromise had been reached and that Hadley would consent to refer the resolution to the Committee on Credentials. The news thrilled Republicans on both sides of the bitter divide. A Pennsylvania delegate dashed to the stage, shouting, "Hadley, the next President of the United States," triggering a boisterous Hadley demonstration. Delegations marched about the hall, exulting in the sudden possibility of a compromise candidate who might unite the party. Just as suddenly, the spell was broken. An attractive young woman in a white dress, with a radiant and infectious smile, stood up in the gallery, blowing kisses and waving a large Roosevelt poster. The band began playing. Shouts of "Teddy, Teddy, Teddy" rose from every corner in the hall. The woman made her way to the floor, escorted through the aisles with the Roosevelt state delegations and placards falling in line.